This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. For many of us in public radio, Studs Terkel was a model, an inspiration, and a pioneer. He died last week at the age of 96. The books of oral histories for which Terkel became famous, Division Street America, Hard Times, Working, and The Good War, his Pulitzer Prize-winning book about World War II, all of those books came about because Terkel was interested enough in the story of America to sit people down with a microphone and tape recorder and press record. Often, those people were ordinary Americans Terkel called the uncelebrated. An energetic and colorful presence, Terkel had been a radio soap actor, sportscaster, and the host of a jazz show in Chicago called The Wax Museum. He went on to host a TV show called Studs Place, but it was canceled after only 2 years. An outspoken liberal in the McCarthy era, Terkel was blacklisted from radio and television. Eventually, he made his way back onto the air as the host of a daily radio show at Chicago station WFMT. Over a 45-year career at WFMT, Terkel interviewed authors, activists, musicians, filmmakers, and comedians. We're going to remember Terkel today by listening back to our 1985 interview with him. But let's start with an excerpt of one of his WFMT interviews. Here he is talking to playwright Tennessee Williams in 1961.
Any discussion of Tennessee Williams, I think, we must keep one factor in mind, that any discussion of Tennessee Williams evokes discussion. Even, I found out, at bars, thank God. And if ever a time when discussion involving the human spirit or the dispirited human is needed, it is now. And we're delighted to be guests of Mr. Williams at this moment in his suite at the Blackstone Hotel. Mr. Williams, how would you describe, was it Kenneth Anna's book of your love for what we call the incomplete people? That is, he was not denigrating them. He merely meant our society makes them incomplete, I believe.
I've always regarded myself as an incomplete person, and consequently, I have always been more interested in my own kind of people, you know, people that have problems, people that have to fight for their reason, you know, the people that to whom, you know, the impact of life and experience from day to day and night to night is difficult, and people who come close to cracking and all that. That's my world. Those are my people. And I must write about the people I know.
Tennessee Williams, speaking with Studs Terkel in 1961. When Terry Gross spoke with Terkel in 1985, she started by asking if he approached interviews with famous people differently than interviews he conducted with the uncelebrated.
No, it's the same. Naturally, when someone wrote a book, I got to read the book. And that takes time. Now, I interview a person, the non-celebrated person, so-called, it's to find out what that person is thinking, but you're exploring new territory. I say I'm like Columbus discovering a new land, and that this person has never been asked about her life before. And that person opens up, and a marvelous thing happens sometimes. And these are those great occasions when that person, in the days when the tape recorder was not as ubiquitous as it is now, that person, hey, could you play that back? I want to hear my voice. And the kids are around her, and you play it back, and that person says, you know, I never knew I felt that way before. Not I never knew I thought. I never knew I felt that way before. It's a tremendous moment of revelation for that person, and of course for me too. I'm kind of like a fellow passenger on a trip, in a way.
How far will you push, though, when you're doing a personal interview? Because some people really want to get someone to confide all their secrets and to break down and cry and reveal
mine's exactly
these
the
deep
opposite.
Emotional things.
No, mine's exactly the opposite. I never trespass on what I think is private domain of a person. Not gossip. No time for that. I'll tell you a story, okay? Years ago, I was interviewing Dana Barrymore. Dana Barrymore was the daughter of the great actor John Barrymore, and she died a number of years ago. Dana Barrymore, at that time, was the subject of scandal magazines. It was a horrible magazine called Confidential. And they go into her sex life, bizarre, her junkiness, her drinking. Then she acts in a Tennessee Williams play, suddenly last summer in Chicago, and she's wonderful. She was a marvelous actress in this play, the girl who was lobotomized, Later on, she did Maggie and Cat on a Hot Tin. So after seeing her in the Tennessee Williams play, I interviewed her. And we're talking about Tennessee Williams, the heroines, what they mean to her. And then we finished the interview, and it's rather good, I thought. She says, haven't you forgotten something? I said, well, I've forgotten a lot of things. What? You haven't asked me those questions. I said, what questions? Well, those questions about my life, you know, that everybody else asks. I said, none of my business. I says, nor the business of the reason. I want to find out about you through your artistry, through your craft. If I had Frank Lloyd Wright on, the architect, would I ask about his wives, whom he left, or left him, or I ask about his architecture? And then she busts out crying. She says, no one has ever said that to me before. She came to accept that as the normal way of things, to accept humiliation. It serves no purpose. I don't do none of my business. That's like peeking through a keyhole or peeking through a transom. And, of course, I resent that very much. So the person tells me of his life with something involving that makes it universal. That's it. It's when somebody reads this, that happened to me. I thought the same thing. That's what I look for. A certain universality in a specific.
Do you think your interviewing's gone through different stages? You know, is the way you interview now the way you started when you began
interviewing? I don't know. Gee, I can't. I think it's different. I think I've gotten older. I think you learn as you go along. But you still have to go round and round and round the mulberry bush. I mean, it's a conversation. And then, rather than interview. Because sometimes I say something about myself, maybe, too, if it helps, you know. Very often, you know, here's a tale out of school. I'm not very good mechanically. You know, I use the tape recorder, right? The tape recorder is my right arm. And I don't know how it works. You know, I can't drive a car. So I goof up a lot, unintentionally. That person helps me, the person I'm interviewing. And when that person helps me, something happens. That person feels needed by me. And to feel needed is terribly important. Many people don't feel needed, you see. So there's no one way. I clown around, horse around.
So it's important for you to not be the star when you're interviewing somebody, not the famous Studs Terkel interviewing
someone. No, well, you see, that becomes, I got to watch that, you see. Isn't that funny? You said the famous Studs Terkel. This is a guy who's in a half-ass way sort of celebrated for interviewing non-celebrated people, which is ironic, is it not, you know? If I took that seriously, I'd be a real oaf, wouldn't I, and a clod. Maybe I am, but I don't take it seriously.
When you interview someone for one of your books, I'm sure you can spend hours or days talking with them as much as you need. But for the radio show, you have, say, an hour.
Mm-hmm.
When that hour's over, even if you feel like you've really gotten to hear a lot about that person, do you ever walk out feeling, well, how much do I really know? You know, and like, is the way they presented themselves in the hour really the essence of who they are?
Well, that always comes up. The author of a book, you try to get whatever the essence of the book is, the theme of the book, maybe read from it, too. He and I, or she and I, both read together. He and I read together, because I'm a ham bone, too. I used to be a Chicago gangster, you know, in radio soap operas. You know, I was a gangster in the days when radio soap operas, a lot of them came out of Chicago, Ma Perkins, you know. And then she was a good middle American family. I was always the guy who says, get in there, you guys. That was me. And then it was Mary Marlin. I gave her a very hard time. You know, she suffered more than St. Teresa ever did, Monday through Fridays, courtesy of Oxydol.
We're remembering oral historian and radio pioneer Studs Terkel. He died last week at age 96. Let's hear another excerpt from Terkel's WFMT radio show. Here he is talking to a young Woody Allen in 1965.
He has the appearance of a graduate student on a Berkeley campus who is quiet but very sympathetic. It's fantasy. His fantasy world is marvelous. Some of it might be autobiographical or not. I know that many listeners have seen him on television, heard his records, and I think he's one of the most comical in the genuine sense guys I've ever seen. So, Woody, who are you? You're like a lot of college students I know, or graduate students, who are kind of shy and awkward,
mm-hmm.
and yet
mm-hmm, yes.
terribly outgoing. It's both. It's paradox.
I am shy and awkward on stage and off stage, and it's just fortunate that I can be heard when I speak on stage so that the jokes get across. But I'm uncomfortable off stage and I'm uncomfortable on stage.
There's always one fall guy, and that's you. I mean, the patsy is you, but as the patsy tells a story about himself...
That happens to be an expression of my personality. You don't find that in every comedian. I find there are two general types, broadly speaking. One type is my type, wherein I'm acted upon consistently. That is, Robert Benchley was like that. Chaplin, to a degree, was like that. And then there's the other kind of comedian, who is the aggressive comedian, like Jonathan Winters or W.C. Fields or Groucho Marx, who come in and aggress on a situation. And, of the two, I would rather my personality naturally was their type. I would rather go around insulting everybody and just decimating people with wit all the time. But, you know, that's not my kind of thing. What generally happens is I come in and try one of those. Nobody laughs. Someone socks me. And, you know, that's my thing. I can't help it. I can't seem to maintain a certain level of cool.
Woody Allen, speaking to Studs Terkel on WFMT in 1965. Terkel hosted his show on the Chicago station for 45 years. Here he is speaking with Terry Gross on our show in 1985.
You've been in Chicago all your life, except for the times when you've been traveling. Why are you that committed to the city? What makes that city really special for you?
Chicago is my home, and it happened there, and it's a kind of, even though I romanticize, a kind of muscularity to it, and its reputation, thanks to Jimmy Cagney and Warner Brothers and Edward G. Robinson, is still boom, boom. You know, Chicago was always a corrupt city, but no more corrupt than other cities. But I call it the big daddy of corrupt cities. And as the respectables are secretly proud when someone goes, Chicago, boom, boom. They're secretly proud of it, in a way.
Did you ever want to move to, like, the West Coast or the East Coast and go to New York or Los Angeles to work at one of the networks?
Never. Never in a million years. There was a time in the early 1950, 51, I was a part of a program called Studs Place. It was early TV. At that time, I got a call to come to New York. And I got so scared to direct Billy Rose, of all things, a Billy Rose program. And I said, no, I really couldn't. I didn't want to go there. You know, the old cliche, good to visit, but that's it. If I'd have died, it's like being without water, you know. My roots are in Chicago. I'm there. It's freewheeling as far as I'm concerned. Whether I could do it in another city, I don't know.
Have you ever lost any radio sponsors because of your politics?
Oh, way in the back. Oh, there was a period in the 50s before I came to the station, FMT. Boy, there was an FMT. I was blacklisted. Oh, sure. Studs Place was knocked off for that reason. I was considered, forgive this phrase, a valuable property. Property is interesting. Because the show was quite popular. It was a kind of program that had an audience of cut through. It had an audience of mainline type ladies who write in a boss stationery, or a charwoman, a scrub lady signing with an ex. Her daughter writes the letter. Truck driver, college professor. It was one of those programs. Well, anyway, the show was finally. It was the McCarthy time, and I signed petitions. Anything, you know, anti-Jim Crow. That was considered subversive back then. I'm talking about the 50s now, before the 60s. And so I'm called to this office in Chicago, and they tell me, gee, I'm a valuable guy. Why am I doing this? You know, I said, well, all I got to say is I've been duped. See, you've been a fool. But I wasn't. I said, see, it's my own ego. It's not my heroism. It's my ego. How dare you say it was one of the few good things I did. I said, of course I signed it. Well, you know, some Reds signed it, too. He said, I don't give a damn if they did. I'm reading what it says. And I like that. And I signed it. Well, you weren't duped. Do you want to say, no, I don't want to look like a fool. It's my ego, you see. So then he says, you know, you got to, an American, you got to stand up and be counted. So I'm sitting in a chair. So I stood up at attention. And they said, we don't think that's very funny. I said, well, I think it's kind of funny. Anyway, you're out, you know. I says, yeah, I guess so. So I was out, you know, for quite a while, off and on. But pick up half a bill here and there, lecturing on jazz or something, or I'd get it, and finally got back on. And one day I was listening to the small station called WFMT, and they're playing a Woody Guthrie record. Well, no one ever played Woody Guthrie on the radio except me on a disc jockey show I did years at 1945 called the Wax Museum. And they played Woody. And I call up and say, you're playing Woody Guthrie. And I told my name, and she said, you, they knew me. I said, listen, I want to work for you. She says, we have no money. And I said, I don't have any either, so it makes us even. So I started working at that station.
Did you grow up in a liberal family? Was your mother liberal?
No, hardworking. My mother, my father was a liberal. My mother was out for the brass ring, you know, and she missed. She ran the hotel. My father did, too, but he was ill. And she was pretty shrewd, pretty bright in money matters, but nobody could take her except a guy named Samuel Insull, who was a big utilities tycoon, took a lot of people to Chicago then. But she always missed the brass ring. But in the hotel where I was raised in this hotel. It was a men's hotel. But in those days, when you say men's hotel, you don't mean flop house. Other word, flop. This was not. This was skilled craftsmen living there. I'm talking about the 20s now. Transient guys who were boomer firemen, carpenters, guys skilled. And a lot of them were self-educated, were autodidacts, you know, and self-taught. And they were argued in the lobby, and that was a big factor in my life, I'd say.
Would you talk to people when you were a kid who were rooming?
Well, I was there. I was kind of the pet. I was a happy child. I was kind of the pet, you know, of the guys and of the people, of my family, too. And I'd go to see plays when I was 13 years old because we lived right near downtown, the Loop, the hotel. So one thing led to another, really.
You went to law school and then left that in favor of acting.
And then
radio
law
performance.
School.
Yeah, why'd you leave law school?
I went to law school, the dream of Clarence Darrow, you know, attorney of the damned. That was the dream. But then I had torts, and then I had contracts, then I had real property. And then this is incredible. I can't hit these legalisms. So it was three unhappy years for me. And people say, you never lose. You never forget law school. Always is good. Baloney. It was three wasted years. I might as well say it.
In your memoir, Talking to Myself, you talk about a scene in the movie Five Easy Pieces. Why don't you share impressions of that? Because that is such a classic scene, love what you have to say about it.
Five Easy Pieces. I know young listeners love this movie, and it was a good, slick movie. It just happened. Before seeing, I interviewed a waitress for the book Working. I remember her name. She's now dead. She was a wonderful woman. I'm Yolanda Leaf. I call her Dolores Dante in the book. Now and then change your name. But in almost every case, I say, we should use my real name. I do it maybe because they might be embarrassed, but they weren't. Anyway, so she's describing her daily work, a waitress, her work. And then I see the movie. And the key scene in that movie, the one they use all the time in the Academy Awards, it was, is this Virago? Here's Jack Nicholson. I'm not blaming him. I'm talking about the character. This guy's going to go to Alaska. He's a great piano virtuoso. And my feeling is, go ahead. I'm not stopping you. You want to go to Alaska? Go ahead. You're a pretty dull guy, you know? And I mean, this is the self-indulgence. I'm talking about the character. And he's there with these companions in this restaurant. And here comes the villain, the waitress, the Virago. And soon she comes on, you know, she's a wrongo. She looks at me, she throws the menu down. He says, could I have a change? I forget the exact scene. But they want a substitution. There's no substitution. Suddenly. And she's behaving so bad that he throws the stuff on the floor. And the kids in the audience, seeing them, stood up and they cheered. And I'm saying, you little so-and-sos, you don't know who this waitress is. This is a setup. Is she tired? How are her varicose veins? Waitresses get a lot of varicose veins. So do stewardesses on planes. And so, how many bufferins did she take? Why is she a waitress? The husband left her. He's dead. He's sick. Kid's in trouble. How tired is she? Did she have a fight with the chef just then behind the doors? They know nothing about her, other than they cheered when he was showing her up. Well, I was so furious about that, because it tells those kids, these people who work aren't much. These are the same yuppies today on the campuses. They know nothing. Nothing about history or the nature of life, you know. And so I was so furious. Well, working taught me, yeah. It taught me. I'm impatient a lot with a telephone operator. No, I know what a telephone operator's life is like. But the great reward comes when I get a letter now and then from somebody. Or this was a young priest walking along the Michigan Avenue Bridge teaching at a school, at a seminary. And he says, you know, my kid said to me, on reading Working, he had Working assigned, They'll never again talk to a waitress the way they did before. Or they'll never again talk to a truck driver the way they did. Well, that's good stuff. That's a reward, yeah. If it can alter a person's attitude, a book, well, you got something.
Studs Terkel, speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. He died last week at the age of 96.